Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
All right, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, you lurking conservatives. How are you? It's Mark Maron again. Surprise, it's the old switcheroo. I was in on Monday for Mr. Hartman. Mr. Hartman shows up tomorrow or yesterday, does his bit, and then I'm back today. I don't know why. I just do what I'm told here. I've been asked to do this, and I enjoy doing it, and it was nice to hear Tom yesterday. I always learn when I listen to Tom Hartman. There's always learning involved. I learned a lot about the Declaration of Independence, and I appreciate that. Because I'm a reactionary mind. I'm not of the ilk of doing my homework. As if you could see me right now, as maybe some of you can, I don't know if that webcam is working or not. But what I will do, not unlike I did with college, is I will surround myself with papers, articles, information about what I need to talk about, and either through some sort of weird proximity or rapid and extreme underlining, I will absorb all the information that is on all the papers surrounding me. So right now I'm trying to take it in. I have two colors of underlining going on. There's the glow-in-the-darky kind of yellowy-green and a pink underlining thing happening. And I'm surrounded by underlined information, and I am lost in a sea of papers. There are some things going on. There's a few things that right off the bat are bothering me today. One is the framing of what Barack Obama is saying about his faith-based ideas, and even using the word faith-based as a reference to a Bush policy, faith-based initiative. The way that the press is framing what Obama said the other day in terms of how he wants to use community outreach through religious organizations is being looked at as a move towards the center by the left, and it's being looked at by the right as an extension of George Bush's plan. And oddly, this plan goes back to Clinton, I believe, and it is an interesting conversation to have, and we are going to have it. Basically, the essence of it is that should government money be given to religious groups for secular purposes that are not defined by religion, that no hiring or firing could be done by for the reason of someone's religious beliefs, and that no hiring or firing or services can be provided because somebody is or isn't of a certain religion. If it is truly giving money in a legitimate way to a religious organization for community services that are not religiously connected, secular or non-secular, for non-secular services, is that wrong? Is it a way to get rid of responsibility that the government should have? See, if you believe in social programs and that the federal government is responsible on some level to take care of its people and some of the basic needs when those needs are taken away or are compromised, which I believe is a progressive point of view, and it is the right thing to do, like national health care, universal health care for all people, some sort of method to help people through hard times, because we're all looking at hard times now. Is this a way around that? And is this and can there be given oversight to this situation? Because what Barack Obama said, and if I could read it here, which I will, is that the speech was made in front of a religious organization. He said, quote, "Now make no mistake, as someone who used to teach constitutional law, I believe deeply in the separation of church and state, but I don't believe this partnership will endanger that idea, so long as we follow a few basic principles. First, if you get a federal grant, You can't use that money, that grant money, to proselytize to the people you help, and you can't discriminate against them or against the people you hire on the basis of their religion. Second, federal dollars that go directly to churches, temples, and mosques can only be used on secular programs and will also ensure that taxpayer dollars only go to those programs that actually work, unquote. So what he's saying is it wrong to disperse taxpayer money through grants to religious-based organizations to use as community outreach without religious purposes? And, of course, what we saw with the Bush administration with faith-based initiatives is it's very easy to get around these rules, that he basically was paying people off. There was all kinds of favoritism. They were overseeing how the money went to specific evangelical groups that will toe the party line to the point of telling their congregations who to vote for. So I think that in a not just a Christian sense, but in a decency sense, in a human sense, and in a progressive sense, that dispersing money to religious organizations to do community work is not such an awful idea. But is there oversight? Is there any way it could not be abused? 866-303-2270. And is it the government's responsibility, the federal government's responsibility, to take up some of this slack, which I believe as well? But the government is broke, and the economy is falling deeper and deeper into a pit. So how do we answer some of these questions? Is Barack Obama actually saying, look, we're in trouble here, and these questions and these problems need to be dealt with, that this period of time, and I believe this to be true, that the challenge that Barack Obama will have when he is president is extreme. He, as I have said before, he is going to be holding the biggest bag of flaming poop in the history of the Republic, and I believe in my heart that the Republicans don't even want this. I believe that they are almost running John McCain as a joke. I believe that they want to give that bag of flaming poop to this president, whoever it may be, and now it is going to be Barack Obama. And after 4 years and during 4 years, they are going to blame him for that bag of flaming poop. And if they do it effectively, who knows what will happen 4 years from now. So the challenge is for Barack Obama to rise to the occasion and be honest with the American people about the economic compromises we're facing, about how overextended we are militarily, and an unjust war keeps going on. So how is he going to reel this stuff in? How is he going to be honest? Is this idea about dispersing grant money and taxpayer money for community purposes to religious organizations with the proper oversight a bad idea? See, I think that we all deserve health care, but I'm one of these people that is so cynical. Honestly, I really believe the reason there is not going to be any nationalized health care is that the way the system is designed, both the healthcare system and the way the government treats it and their partnership with the insurance companies, is that it is designed that once you can't afford treatment, you're no longer necessary in the game. So the reason I see that there's not going to be nationalized healthcare is because they need the turnover. They don't care about poor people. They don't care about people who are compromised. But you would think in the day that the time we're living in now, where the economy is at such a point that everybody is hurting because of it, myself included. This is the weird thing about Americans, is that we have such a sense of entitlement and denial that we refuse to admit that we're in the soup, that we're in trouble, until it gets so bad it's undeniable. And the bottom line is that even you people with good credit, which is the buttress to your denial and what you're planning on riding this thing out, eventually that's going to run out and we're all going to be in the same pot. Now, why don't Americans really stand up? Is the only way that you can stand up is to vote for somebody? Why aren't more Americans pissed off, you know, visibly pissed off? I mean, in Korea, South Korea, they are protesting American meat because it's tainted with mad cow disease in one incident, and they're refusing to import it. They're that pissed off about food, specific types of food imports, and they're that cohesive as a group. But Americans, we are so intent on pretending that we're doing okay to the people in our immediate environment that we refuse on some level to show that we're hurting. And we are. And there's got to be some way to solve some of these problems. I mean, if you look at what's just the news today, so a woman in Kentucky is arrested for prostituting herself for gas money. I'm paraphrasing the situation, but that's how she's going to ride this out. Okay? Auto sales and auto manufacturing profits are down because no one finally, everyone's like, you know what? I can't afford an SUV. How long does it take for people to realize these things? It's amazing that the very thing that gets us into trouble, which is credit and not paying our debts in some respects, is exactly, you know, what eventually the point I'm trying to make is that I don't know what it's going to take to level this thing out. And I would like to take some calls on the faith-based initiative thing. I'm a little hit in the head today. Kim in San Francisco, how are you?
Hey, Mark, it's good to hear you again.
Thanks.
The main thing I think about the faith-based initiatives, I don't like it. It makes me nervous about the church and state deal. But moreover, this is, you're talking about introducing government money to churches, and that's just a formula. I'm a Catholic. I'm not the world's best Catholic, but money and the Catholic Church, you can go back to the de' Medicis. It's risky. But moreover, Mark, is my feeling is this. We have many, many, many government agencies that have been cut down to the bone.
That's right.
In addition to that, these agencies were supposed to protect us. In fact, they were not protecting us. But the bottom line is this country is broke. Get rid of the marginal programs like faith-based initiatives that are mixed blessings. And let's put some money back into the departments and the programs, make them work for the American people, and put money aside for enforcement. We have laws, labor laws specifically that I'm familiar with, that have never, ever been enforced. And frankly, there's not enough people in the government anymore to enforce them. So all we have our corporate cronies in all these positions in departments of our government. We need to get rid of the crap, which, frankly, faith-based initiatives are, and put it back in the things, the Labor Department, the FAA. Let's start looking at our food, shall we?
Exactly.
Making sure it's safe. And we need to get adult on this. Stop being
a child. Stop thinking that. Stop following your sense of entitlement and start to look at things rationally. Thanks a lot, Kim. I think that's the point I'm trying to make. I'm sorry if I'm a little all over the place. It's just that when you don't get into a regular groove of doing radio every day, sometimes you got to rework yourself and reconnect with what the pace of things as they are. But I think that what she is saying is absolutely right. Is that this sense of entitlement, the self-centeredness that so many Americans experience, the idea that it's not going to happen to them, has really allowed the government and allowed corporations and allowed corporate interests in the government to take over everything. And a lot of people just don't care. They don't vote. They don't care as long as they got credit, as long as they can afford their food in the morning and their Starbucks and they feel okay about themselves. They don't care because they don't feel like they have to. But so much of that is based on a false belief system that it's not going to happen to them and that their credit will last forever and that eventually everything's going to be peachy and they're going to win the lottery. And that type of thinking, that type of entitlement and denial, I think, is epidemic in this country and is going to have to stop. It's going to have to stop by choice because there's no way to keep going on with that type of thinking. And what happens at that moment, whether people wake up or get desperate, that's really going to be in the hands of whoever's leading this country. It's Mark Maron. I'm in for Tom Hartman. We're getting focused. Don't worry. We're getting focused. I'll be back in a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Okay, folks, about 23 past the hour, it's Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman, trying to wrap my brain around things. Today, we got a good show. We got guest Sarah Posner in a little while. She's a columnist for the American Prospect and the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Value Voters, which is exactly how this is being framed, Obama's speech as an extension of Bush's faith-based initiative program. I seem to feel in my gut that it is different. It seems a little more nuanced, and it seems that it's going to require oversight. But there is definitely a chasm here between how people think about this, certainly on the left, in that do we restore government programs back to what they were before they were all cut? Do we start enforcing more oversight within the government as opposed to selling it out to corporate cronies and thus just enabling corporate entities to pillage the government and kill people with their negligence. And because they have cronies within the FDA, the in any number of government branches, that the whole thing has been sold out? Or is this part of an earnest outreach on behalf of Obama and the idea as not so much a Band-Aid, but a reasonable idea, if you provide the right oversight, to let churches and mosques and temples do community work with government money? Judy in Mahwah, New Jersey, what's your thoughts on this?
Hi. Yeah. Well, I have some factual experience. I was on the vestry of an Episcopal church in Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan. We were a poor church in a poor neighborhood. We knew what needed doing, but we didn't have the money. So we took advantage of the government grants that have always been there and the contracts. A lot of the contract work for social service was done by religious organizations, but it was done under the kind of guidelines that Obama is talking about now. Bush's Office of Faith-Based Initiatives took those guidelines and threw them out the window. He did pay favorites. He didn't care if you discriminated in hiring. He basically didn't care if you proselytized. We were always aware of what we had to do. We had to act like a secular organization. We had to observe all the same rules, and we got the money to do what our neighborhood needed to have. That, we felt, was our mission. And as far as proselytizing goes, I always thought that setting a good example was the best, you know, letting your actions speak. If you're doing good, you don't need to tell people you're doing good. And so we had an after-school program. We had English as a second language. We had a summer camp. We had a food pantry. We had an enormous amount of community outreach, and we didn't have the budget for it. But we got it from the government, state, the city.
Okay, all right. Well, that's a good story.
We obeyed the rules, and that's why I got so furious about Bush. He threw the rules out the window.
Well, thank you for your call. I appreciate your call, Judy. And I guess that really is the issue, because even when she was just talking to me, you realize that even if a religious organization does all this good work, you are still within the umbrella of that religious organization. So you are going to identify that work with the religious organization, and there may not need to be proselytizing involved for you to become acclimated and a follower of whatever that religious organization is. And I guess in that way, on a very specific, you know, philosophical way, and the way that our brains change, that it is an infringement on the separation of church and state, and it cannot be anything other than that. I'm sorry I'm thinking out loud on this, but I appreciate your calls. We're going to talk to Sarah Posner in a second, who will shed some light on this also. She wrote a book called God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. We'll be back with her in just a second. Marin in for Hartman.
Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, it's about 35 past the hour. It's Mark Marin in for Tom Hartman, trying to wrap our brain around this idea that Barack Obama has and how it is different than George Bush's. The faith-based initiative of George Bush is now being tagged on to a presentation that Barack Obama made about his policies that are revolving around similar incentives. I'll quote Barack Obama before I bring on our guest. Quote, few basic principles. First, if you get a federal grant, you can't use that grant money to proselytize the people you help, and you can't discriminate against them or against the people you hire on the basis of their religion. Second, federal dollars that go directly to churches, temples, and mosques can only be used on secular programs and will also ensure the taxpayer dollars only go to those programs that actually work. End quote. This is being seen by the right and the left as a big sort of pandery reach out to religious voters. It's also being seen as centrist. It's also being seen as non-progressive in the sense that it does not encourage us to put the responsibility back into government in terms of oversights and reallocating money to social programs that were once working. My guest right now is the author of Gods and Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters, and she's a contributor to the Daily Prospect. Sarah Posner, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's good to, I'm glad you're here because this just came up and now we can talk about it. How do you see this? I mean, you're somebody who deals with the pulse of what religious voters are doing, who they are, how they break up. And I want to talk about that specifically in a minute. But do you feel that this is some sort of anti-constitutional movement that that Barack Obama is engaging in to pander to the religious people?
Well, I mean, clearly there are constitutional issues that need to be addressed, what it is that he's proposing and how it's going to be different from the Bush faith-based initiative, which is fraught with constitutional problems. Now, he says that, you know, he wouldn't allow any discrimination in the hiring or service provision by groups that get faith-based funds, and that he wouldn't allow proselytizing. But, you know, this absence of proselytizing is a very, very difficult thing to police. Like, say, for example, you have given federal funds to a group in a community which is like, you know, 90% Christian. You know, what's going to happen when, you know, a Hindu comes in for services or a Buddhist comes in for services? You know, who's gonna say that they turned them down or they didn't proselytize to this person?
I guess, yeah, and that's my question, too, is that, and I realized that when I was talking to a caller, is that once you give the money to a religious organization, that is the organization that has the money. No matter how they're behaving in relation to the rules or the provisions of the incentive, that is where they are coming. This is where desperate people or people that need help are coming. So even without proselytizing, it exists in the format or the context of this religious organization.
Right. I mean, it's very, I think, hard to separate, you know, what is proselytizing and what is the provision of the service within the context of this religious organization. And like I said, I think it's going to be next to impossible for the government to police that, especially in smaller organizations and smaller communities that are getting these grants. And that's something that's a very deep concern. Another concern is that the government would be putting money directly into houses of worship, which raises all sorts of constitutional questions, of course. Now, some church-state separation advocates have been saying, well, you know, it would be better, maybe not perfect, but better if the program required the House of Worship to create a separate 501c3 organization to receive the money. That way there would be more accountability. The government wouldn't be meddling in the church's finances so much. And that would be sort of a cleaner way of making sure that it was a provision of secular services. But it wasn't clear to me from Obama's speech or the talking points that his campaign put out that that was something that he envisioned.
And I guess the issue about centrism and his move towards the center is that why can't we have a discussion about how we can fix the government to more effectively provide for people who are in these situations and in these communities without being embarrassed about it without being afraid to be accused of being some sort of Democrat who's going to increase taxes and create a welfare state, that dialogue doesn't even happen. So I guess it can be seen as sort of an excuse to not engage in fixing the government.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously it would be taxpayer money that would be funding the faith-based initiative. So, you know, whether it goes to whether that money is being spent on a government program that's administered by the government or a secular grantee of the government, or whether it's being sent to a faith-based organization, it's still taxpayer money. You know,
right, but then the constitutional element really comes into play in
that. I mean, but as far as whether Obama moved to the center on this, I mean, he has been talking about this sort of thing for a while, but as you noticed, I mean, he did not bring it out as the centerpiece of his campaign during the primaries. He waited until the primaries were over to really, you know, make the big speech on that.
Right. And it's interesting, though, too, that the discussion in religious terms or about, you know, moral or issues, or as they're called sometimes, is that this is something that's very broad. And I guess some of the questions I have for you is that you're hearing a lot that the religious right or the evangelical base has sort of dispersed or broken up, or that there's infighting about what's important to them as a voting bloc at this point in time. Is any of that true? Is it a different landscape, or are they just underground a bit?
The thing you have to understand at the outset is evangelicals, they comprise about 25 to 30% of the U.S. adult population. About half of them are conservative, so half of them you would put in the religious right column. And then, you know, another, you know, 30 to 40% of them are sort of centrist, and then maybe 10% of them are what you might be able to call progressive.
So you're saying that half of them are conservative, which means that their Christian intentions are dubious. And about 10% of them are probably, you know, real Christians.
If you want to characterize it that way.
Right.
But in any case, I don't think that Obama is holding out a lot of hope of getting that any part of that 50% that is conservative. But that middle section, that 40 or so percent that's centrist, these were people that for a long time were fairly reliably Republican voters who this year are looking around for an alternative. They're peeling away from the Republican Party a bit. They're not peeling away to the Democratic Party. They're becoming independents as opposed to becoming Democrats.
Well, now, what are those reasons? I mean, are these for you know, gay marriage and abortion reasons? Are these for economic reasons? Are these reasons?
It's a lot of reasons. I think some of it is discussed with the religious right and the inordinate focus on abortion and gay marriage. But a lot of it is also torture. A lot of them are opposed to the Bush administration policy on torture. They're opposed to the Iraq war. They're concerned about the economy. They're concerned about the environment. So there's sort of a more expansive menu of issues that they're concerned about. Now, that doesn't mean that they're looking for, you know, an FDR-style New Deal or, you know, LBJ war on poverty or something like that, but they're not just being reflexively Republican.
Okay,
it's those voters that Obama is trying to reach because, like I said, they're not, you know, they're not liberal or progressive in the sense that you and I might think of, you know, government solving problems. So he's using this as part of his outreach to that.
So when you have leaders like John Hagee and you have leaders like James Dobson and you have these leaders, I guess what's happening in some of the stuff that spurred some of this change of heart on is that once these leaders became, you know, sort of transparent power jockeys, that, you know, they became disillusioned with their own leadership. And I think maybe they're becoming more practical and perhaps even focusing more on their communities.
Yeah, I mean, I think that definitely is happening. And with a lot of them, they still remain fairly politically conservative. I mean, I would not, you know, point to this.
Don't hold out hope.
That's you know, some mass exodus to the Democratic Party.
Yeah, yeah.
But like I said, you know, Obama is looking at particularly, I think, a few states where there's a strong evangelical presence and hoping that, you know, by peeling away some segment of that 40% and certainly a good segment of the 10% that's more progressive, that could turn the election in some key states.
Now, these states, is this primarily, I know that there is an incredible expansion in the Latino evangelical community, and I assume that he is definitely reaching out to that community
in
a lot.
When he had the meeting with the 30 or so Christian leaders a couple weeks ago in Chicago, one of the people who was there was Sam Rodriguez, who's the president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, which is the largest Latino evangelical organization in the country, representing about 15 million Latino evangelicals. And so that's a very big voter bloc, big and incidentally big in states where there's a gay marriage ban on the ballot in Florida and in California. And that leadership is promoting the gay marriage ban and advocating for the gay marriage ban. So they part company with Obama on that.
Okay. So now do you think that in terms of how McCain has made himself look in his desperation to pander to the worst of the leaders, do you think Obama is being diplomatic and do you think he's being earnest in his outreach?
Well, obviously, you know, he has been a church going person for 20 years. And I don't doubt that he, is a person of faith, but I think a lot of what he's done in the past couple of weeks is for political expediency and for winning the election. You know, there's no doubt that the meeting with the, 30 or so pastors and inviting some, you know, very conservative ones in the mix, the proposal for the faith-based initiative, his upcoming Joshua Generation project, which will be about outreach to younger evangelicals. He's doing a lot of politically minded things to make himself look appealing to voters for whom it's very important that the candidate be a person of faith.
But he's not promising them a theocracy, which is relieving.
Well, he is promising them a role for faith in government and faith in politics. Now, that doesn't mean that he's proposing some sort of Christian reconstructionist thing a la, you know, some of the leaders of the Christian right.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that it's lacking in constitutional issues.
Well, yeah,
along the way.
Right. I appreciate your thoughts on this, and thanks for talking to us, Sarah.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Take care. Sarah Posner, author of Gods and Prophets, God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters, and she's contributed to Daily Prospect. It is a slippery slope, and I'm learning things as I speak to you people. Because I'm relatively I'm sort of a heathen. I don't have a God in place, and I kind of spin around, and I try to be rational, but I know I'm not in control of everything. But I'll take some calls on this again, 866-303-2270, about Obama's, do you see it as pandering? Do you see it as necessary? Is it wrong for the left to start criticizing Obama for moving towards the center? Isn't there some argument to be made that let's get the guy in and stack the Congress and stack the Senate towards the right direction and maybe make a move progressively in that way? So, you know, he has to do their bidding. I mean, is this a time to take shots at Obama around this stuff? And also, I will take calls on the constitutionality of his proposition. Because now I'm in this weird gray area where I tend to believe in people. I tend to think that people are good. And I tend to think that a lot of times what religious organizations do in communities is earnest and decent. But I guess I'm in the minority. It's weird because I'm not a big fan of believers. But as I said, I don't have a God of my own. But I do think that there is a behavior that is available for people who behave in a quote unquote Christian way. That is sometimes helpful. Give me a call. It's Mark Maron for Hartman. It's coming up on 10 before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270. Okay,
it's Maron in for Hartman. I'm just sitting here filling my heart with love. Is that okay? Is that what we do? Is that a spiritual thing to do? I'm sitting here filling my heart with love for all people and forgiving. All right, it went away. It just went away. I've gotten so worked up about this kind of stuff before. I'm amazed, given what I do on stage and given how I think about things, that more Christians and more members of other religious communities have not reached out to me. I am lost. Save me. They don't, so I have to rely on women, which never works. Okay, here we go. Kathy, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. How are you?
Well, I just wanted to say that I do believe in the separation of church and state. And I don't believe that we should be giving tax dollars to religious institutions that are exempt from paying taxes. And at this time in the county I live in, Broward County, I know that we have so many cutbacks right now that I wonder why we're not questioning whether or not churches should start paying real estate taxes.
So you believe there's no slippery slope, that any money given to churches is an infringement on the Constitution, and that's the way it is, that the investigation should be, you know, why aren't they paying taxes? Why do we got to carry their weight? And why isn't the government doing more to take care of its own people?
Well, I don't think it's black and white.
Right.
But I would definitely say I prefer separation of church and state in all cases. I know the churches do a lot of good things, but I've personally been in mass where the priest was on the podium speaking out against abortion.
That's right. So then it becomes something that's proselytizing. I appreciate your call.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I guess that really is a slippery slope. And at some point, you got to make a call. And I think by the end of this hour, perhaps the end of the next half hour, I will make a call that there is no room for this because there is no way to define what proselytizing is. I guess it's a very specific idea, but if you're in a desperate situation and you are taken in by the church in a secular way, there's a community reach out and the church has provided you food. It's provided you some place to live. Maybe it's given you a little job, but they're not saying, you know, you got to be a Christian, but you're going there every day. And there's a lot of Bibles laying around. There's a guy in a cross up in the corner. I mean, at some point, it's going to have some effect. It's historically proven effective at getting into people's heads. So just the existence of it may imply that this is an infringement on the Constitution, no matter what. Keep telling me. Let's keep having this discussion. I'm learning. Portland, Oregon, Torrance, how are you?
How are you?
Good, man.
Good, good. You might get mad at this call. But after listening to everyone talk, I've got a couple of comments. One comment is that people should stop being so selfish and stop talking about left, right, and center, because everywhere you go, there's just Americans standing. That's number one. Number two is that for the last 15 years, I've either volunteered, sat on a board, or worked in a nonprofit as a project coordinator or a community health outreach worker or a social worker. And I've worked for nonprofits that got state, federal, county funding.
Yeah.
And then I also worked for Breaking Barriers, which started under MCC, which was a church, right?
Okay.
But the church was the parent company or the parent umbrella financial for the Breaking Barriers. 5 years later, Breaking Barriers became their nonprofit. And the way that people should stop saying faith-based whatever and just open up the grant processes to everybody, because there's guidelines. And MCC, the church part of it, said it was just too much for them to do because they were checking with the guidelines and following up on the people. And you got to keep the money separate. And we had Buddhists working for us. We had Catholics. I don't go to church, but I guess I would be Christian. But that had nothing to do. I worked in the field of HIV and AIDS prevention education,
right.
And I was the homeless case manager. Well,
I appreciate the call. I think that what he's saying basically is that we can look at it can you look at it as grassroots, just grassroots organizing. That once it is distinct from the church, and this should the money be made available to everybody that does it, and maybe just level the playing field like that. You see, I don't, you know, look, AA meetings meet in the basement of churches all the time, and they are certainly not affiliated. You'll never meet a bigger group of demons in exile who question God, who question every part of what they're doing to save their lives, and there's no connection to a church whatsoever. Obviously, that's different, but I tend to believe that that some of these churches provide very good and reasonable programs for the community, and people are fairly worked up about this. I got a full phone bank. We do have a long break here. But if you want to stay on the line and continue the discussion, I'm going to tell you a little story about how I almost became a Christian for about 10 minutes. So stay with me. It's Marin, in for Hartman, top of the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, folks, it's 6 past the hour. How are you, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and you lurking conservatives? It is Mark Maron. I am in for Tom Hartman. I'm pretending to be smart. That's how they say it in New England. Are you smart? Hey, you think you're smart, don't you? Hey, look, we're talking about this initiative. There's a lot of words that you can use, but it's an initiative that has been put forth by Barack Obama. In a speech he gave in front of religious folks, about what is being seen as an extension or a derivation or perhaps something similar to Bush's faith-based initiatives. It's being viewed by the right as just a reinterpretation of it, and by the left as a reinterpretation of it, and as a sellout to progressive values. And we're having a conversation about whether or not it is possible, really, to give money to religious organizations and enable them to do community work and provide services on a secular basis, which means they do not discriminate on the basis of religion or proselytize. And I just had a discussion with Ron Kuby here behind the scenes, who's a constitutional lawyer, because I'm having a little bit of a difficult time wrapping my brain around how it could be constitutional at all, in the sense that, as I've talked to you people, that given the nature, in my mind, look, I've been to Italy. Have you ever been to Italy? Have you ever gone into a cathedral in Italy? These cathedrals were built so big, so huge, so much money and art and amazing, awesome, overpowering structural thing, details were put into this. I was a grown man when I went there. We're talking like 5 years ago, and you walk into some of these cathedrals, and I was brought to my knees. And if I was in any way confused or on the brink of believing, and certainly if I was a believer, I would have been, this is amazing. Look at the power of God here. So in my mind, that given that if you are giving money to a religious organization to do services, the proselytizing thing is what I talked to Ron about, which is that what's unconstitutional is that given the nature of the religions that proselytize the most, say Islam or Christianity, where it is their duty to recruit, it is going to be too great a temptation. It is going to be, they would be going against God not to proselytize, given the possibility or the opportunity to do so. So in that sense, it would be impossible to monitor unless the government provided atheists for every church to oversee whether or not there was actual proselytizing going on. Or maybe not even atheists, because that puts it into a religious context. Perhaps just, you know, maybe just confuse people that need a job but are assigned an oath to not get religious in any way. So that's where it becomes a slippery slope. But I also think it becomes a slippery slope constitutionally just by nature of the service being provided and the structure of the place and the being surrounded by religious artifacts and religious context all the time. That would be hard if you were in a desperate situation being provided these services, not to begin to believe in something that resembles your environment, because that's what people do. Through repetition, they start to store things as truth. This is a very interesting article I found. Maybe I'll get to that. But I have had moments of doubt. I've had moments where I remember one specific one years ago, and it was fleeting, but I'll share it with you. It was late at night, and I was watching Bob Tilton on television. I don't know if you remember Bob Tilton, but he was a minister or a preacher or a snake oil salesman. He was one of those guys who had a TV show on late at night, and he used to speak in tongues. And I'm sitting there by myself. It's late at night. No one's home. It's like 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. I'd just done comedy. At that time, I was probably a little high. And he used to do this thing where he'd raise his hand up, and he would say, I sense there's somebody in the audience with a pain in their stomach. Is there anybody out there with a pain in their stomach? I sense there is. Well, if that person would come to his TV screen, place his hand on my hand, I will heal that pain. And I got up from the couch. I was moving, because I had a little pain in my stomach. So I was moving towards the screen with my hand outreached, and I had to stop myself because I was like, what am I doing? What am I doing? I would, because I had that moment like, I would rather be caught masturbating, all right, than sitting on my knees with my hand on the TV screen, touching Bob Tilton's hand and hope that the pain in my stomach would go away with the power of Jesus. And I had to stop myself because I could explain if my girlfriend at the time walked in and I was masturbating. What are you doing? What do you think I'm doing? I'm doing this. This is what I'm doing. But if I was on my knees with my hand on the TV screen, I would be hard pressed for an explanation. I don't know. I'm just, the guy said, I'm cleaning it. I'm lost. I'm lost. I need help. Ken in Sturbridge, Massachusetts. What do you think about what Obama's talking about?
Well, first off, don't forget, Mark, that we have to, as in tax form, have to pay for monitoring to make sure that they're keeping up to snuff. And let's make it a little bit clear that I understand why Obama's doing this. I perfectly well understand. But if this had been Hillary doing it, the Obamaites would be screaming pandering.
That's right. But that war is over for the time being, and now it's he's our guy.
Yeah, and I understand that. I just think that the people who will defend anybody for whatever reason need to understand, you know, the insights of others.
That this is politics, is what you're saying. That this is politics, and it's very clear what he's doing, and any one person is going to have to decide how they feel about this movement towards the center or his broadening his campaign to perhaps get more voters that were on the fence or perhaps for Hillary or are still on the fence.
Yeah, plus when you move away from your base, and I don't think that's a great move. And as far as I'm concerned, I agree with Kathy. We should have been taxing the churches and the synagogues and the mosques a long time ago. They are businesses. I'm sorry, that's what they are. If they want to do good works, then let them do it out of the good of their heart, not because they get some kind of break.
Thank you very much. Good point. Yeah, I don't know what is being done out of the good of anyone's heart. I find that as time goes on, unfortunately, finding people who do things out of the goodness of their heart, it's hard because people who really do things out of the goodness of their heart, they don't announce it. They have a certain humility. They are humble, and they just plod on doing it. And I always have to question myself, and it becomes a question of selfishness, of self-centeredness. And just the fact, like, did you see that thing yesterday? That tape, I think it was run on MSNBC. It was a hospital here in New York City. It was a city hospital. It was Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn in the psychiatric unit. A woman had stayed in that psychiatric unit's emergency room lobby waiting room for hours. She was sitting there with other people waiting for a bed to find out she could be admitted, and she collapsed, and she laid on the floor convulsing and twitching and turning for a half an hour until she died. And they claimed that they were taking care of people, but then there was videotape. And the videotape showed not only two or three people in and out of the waiting room at different times, but a security guard rolling around on a desk chair, peeking in, seeing the woman on the floor, and then rolling out. And then when someone finally came to give her attention, the first thing they did was kick her a little bit to see if she'd move. Now, what the hell causes that? Last month, a guy was hit by a car, I believe, in Connecticut, flipped over the car, landed on the street, and laid there dying, and nobody did anything in the middle of a busy street. What is that about? What are people so afraid of? What are people so self-consumed with that they can't check to see if someone's all right? Are we that jaded? Are we that self-involved? That those are indications to me of the real problem of why when somebody calls me up and says, you got to get rid of political labels, right, left, Democrat, Republican, and just realize we're all Americans in trouble. Well, we're all selfish because of America and what America's become on some level. We've all been isolated into our homes. There's no reason to even go out anymore. You can shop online. You can have sex online. You can talk to other people online. And I'm guilty of this. Yesterday, I just broke up with a girl online. I don't know who did it. It's unclear to me. But where is the humility in that? Where is the exchange? Where do you learn wisdom? Where do you learn from your mistakes if you can't look at somebody and see how they're reacting to what you're saying? If you can't actually go over to someone's house and talk to them? If you're immersed in yourself and toys that will just isolate you? We're just like the little emperors of our own desks. We're just little kings. And we're all none of the emperors have any clothes because they're sitting there watching the wrong things online. But what I'm saying is that the idea of community in and of itself is disintegrating altogether. An online community is not really a community. A community where people take real action, where people help each other. I mean, that's what you would hope would happen. That's what the New Deal represented. That's what America should be about. But we've all become isolated, and because of the way our brain works, our belief systems are what they are. They're very hard to shake, and a lot of people will just seek information that supports their own belief system. It's a disaster. And one of the greatest examples of this that I saw was on CNN, and it really struck me because you have people who interpret catastrophe and disaster in a religious way. Like the floods in the Midwest. This is when it first started happening. People are losing their homes. Thousands of people are out of their homes. Levees are breaking. Main streets are flooding. The Mississippi has made a decision, and it's very hard to stop the Mississippi when it makes a decision. Now, you can look at that as a sign of the end. You can look at that as an environmental catastrophe that was bound to happen. But what I saw on CNN was a guy standing on a flooded main street, abandoned, destroyed, reporting for CNN, talking about how horrible it was. This flood is horrible. Thousands of people have their homes. It's going to cost millions and billions of dollars to fix. And then out of nowhere, he pulls a fishing net out and says, but you know what? You can fish on Main Street. And he tries to catch a fish. That, my friends, is the sign of the end of the world. That a room full of producers and a guy reporting on one of the great tragedies, certainly of the last 20 years, and decides, like, this will be good. Let's try and catch a fish. That'll be cute. Yeah, where were the pissed off farmers that would just took the net out of his hand, stuck his head in the water, and say, what the hell's the matter with you? We're in trouble here. Why don't you send us some help, Wolf? And he did it 2 days running until he caught a fish. Who lets that happen? Who lets a guy stand in the street, die in the street after he was hit by a car? Who lets a woman die in a waiting room of a hospital? Who decides it's a good idea to catch a fish on a flooded Main Street when there are thousands of people out of their homes and millions of dollars are going to be needed to help those people? And I'm sitting at home going, yeah, I feel bad for them. I'm not doing anything. Who's doing something? People who really help. Are you one of them? Is there really community? All right, I'll take some more calls. 866-303-2270. It's 18 past. I'm Marin in for Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Okay, 22 past, Mark Maron. I'm in for Tom Hartman. I'm coming to grips with my own spiritual untetheredness. Is that a word, untetheredness? I just make it up. I'm understanding things. I'm trying to understand why we're so selfish and why everything's so crazy and why we've been just rent our brains out to corporate sponsorship on all levels. I'm going to talk to a woman in a few minutes. That it's just amazing how easily we are led in the wrong direction, certainly by religion, but mostly by propaganda, marketing. Billions and billions of dollars go into political propaganda, into selling us stuff, into the fact that the woman I'm going to talk to in a minute, because we're going to have to switch gears to get into it, is that it's amazing to me how we have been convinced through technology, and originally through religion, but through marketing and technology, that we need things that we don't, and that's really the spirituality of America, is that, you know, how do I fill the hole? How do I keep filling it? How do I keep up? What do I need to fix me? And I never really thought about it, but do you remember there was a time where you could get through a day without water? Seriously, in my lifetime, I did not have to drink a gallon of water a day. Fascinating. It seems so long ago. Like, I go into a panic. Like, is there a bottle of water? Now I'm going to get in my car. Do you have water? Now I got to walk from my apartment down the street. Wait, maybe I should get a bottle of water. Oh, I'm out of water. Which water should I get? This one's fun. Look at, it's got a mountain on it. This one's from the ground. This one has vitamins in it. What are we, suckers? I've gone back to drinking tap water and I make my own coffee. I'm off the grid. I'm drinking right out of tap out of a glass, and I'm making my own coffee at home. Cheap coffee. I'm off the grid. I might as well vote for Ron Paul. Hey, getting off point. I want to talk to this guy. No, I'm going to wait on him. Can we take Terry? Will you take Terry in Seattle, Washington? Terry, how are you?
Hi.
Hey, what's up, man?
Well, Mark, I've listened to you Monday, and you're blowing me away. I had a comment. You're almost throwing me off my comment.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, the stuff you said about the internet and the way we learn. And my original comment was that you had said something about sort of Christian values. And I'm trying to be a come out of the closet atheist. I'm reading Richard Dawkins' book and finding it wonderful. But I'm thinking, you know, instead of Christian, you know, these values, are they not human or humane, that the Christians don't own these ethics? And also some of the things that you're talking about, there's a, I believe it's a Latin saying, it's called bread and circuses, that you give the people bread and circuses and you satisfy them, they don't look at the issues.
Right, American Idol, reality television.
Lindsay Lohan, pick one.
Well, I like looking at her, but I am a minority.
Oh, I do too, but yeah. Also there's thinking that you're saying the thing about going into church. Joseph Campbell once said that he was talking to a friend who was in the concentration camps, and he was a... Holocaust survivor, and that this guy was in a, they forced him to be in one of those huge Nazi fiasco things. With
right.
Him. And he said that the guy, you know, had all he could do to stop himself from giving the, you know, the Nazi salute. And that, you know, and that's the power of those things. So like you're talking about the, you know, what happens when you're,
in the
you
presence,
know,
in the it's overpowering. It's almost some type of Stockholm syndrome. In that, if that you are spiritually untethered or desperate or lost or seeking answers, that if the propaganda is big enough, if the song is loud enough, it will deliver itself into your that part of your brain that stores it as truth.
Right. Right.
Well, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Sorry, been a little scattered. The hippocampus. That's what it is, the hippocampus. So look, I'm going to try and evolve into how we're misguided into buying water after this. And then I'm going to read something funny about the right-wing religious wackos. And I understand it. And I do believe that those are human values. But my friend Tom Rhodes, a comedian, said something to me that resonated. There's little moments that resonate that people say. And he's a believer. But he said to me, hell was designed to make stupid people act right. So, yeah, they are human values, but they have to be learned no matter what, unfortunately, because we are kind of selfish animals. Be back in a few. It's Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman, doing my best to understand. I need to understand. Belief. Brand loyalty requires an almost religious faith. They plant it in our heads, folks. I just got an IM from a buddy of mine, and this is in sort of closing some of the discussions we were having before about spirituality. A very nice quote. The quote is, "We are here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness." That's Thich Nhat Hanh, if I'm quoting it correctly. He was a expatriate Vietnamese Zen Buddhist monk. But I think that is something. That is where it all goes to. Rational thinkers, sociobiologists, Edward O. Wilson, everything is sort of operating in a frequency that is all part of the other. I kind of dig that. Maybe Buddhism is where I need to go. But this article that I was talking about 2 days ago and a little bit today about how we process information and what we base our beliefs on. Apparently in America, 18% of Americans think the sun revolves around the earth. 10% think that Barack Obama is some sort of Muslim, homosexual, communist from another planet. And they really believe it. And that is because the way we take things into our head, facts are first stored in the hippocampus, which is deep in the brain. It's a little thing the size of a finger. And then every time we recall it, our brain writes it down again, and it sort of restores it. So it doesn't work like a hard drive. So what happens is eventually it's just up in the frontal cortex, and it's a repetition of a fact that no longer – there's something called source amnesia. So it becomes detached from wherever it came from. And source amnesia no longer knows whether it was true or not. And a lot of people base their beliefs on that. And this comes through repetition. If something is stuck into the hippocampus and then enforced on a fairly regular basis, you will believe it even if it's not true. And you can't shake those beliefs because you will just find things to support it. It's weird that the brain is designed for us to have debates with ourselves. We have to check ourselves. We have to be deliberate and think things through and ask and reassess where things come from. And one of the great examples of that is what I was talking about before. Do you need to drink 20 bottles of water a day? I mean, I buy boatloads of bottled water. It's as if every day I'm preparing for the end of the world. Yeah, you know, I'll go to Costco. I go to Trader Joe's. I'm like, I better get a thing of water. I got two things of water in my trunk. But part of me really thinks that, like, what if everything happens bad and I need water? I don't want to be stuck in my car that's not running while all the badness that ever could happen is happening around me and not have water. And I think that's planted in there. But it's also the idea that it's healthy and that bottled water is better. But somebody's going to tell us different. I hope I pronounce her last name right. She is the author of Bottle Mania, How Water Went on Sale and Why We Bought It. She's a journalist and environmentalist. Elizabeth Reut, is it?
Yes, it is.
Well, I'm so glad you're here because, it's weird that how we're tying, how you become. I didn't know how this show was going to start, but we've been talking a lot about it started with faith-based initiatives, and I sort of brought it into the realm of belief. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the power of marketing and the power of how brand and product is identified that we really grow to believe in. And I have and do still, you're going to have to shake it from me, believe that I need bottles of water around me at all times.
Uh-huh.
Now, I remember when there was a time where I don't think I drank a glass of water a day. I'd have a soda, maybe some coffee, but it didn't seem essential to me. What happened?
Well, did you go from drinking soda to drinking bottled water or from soda to tap water?
Well, I would always drink tap water, and I knew some tap waters were better than others. There was always the idea that New York tap water is the greatest tap water, and some of it tastes like chlorine, some of it tastes weird. But I've gone back to tap water, and I make my own coffee. I'm heading off the grid, Elizabeth.
Good.
So what? Now tell me, when did that happen? Because I do believe that bottled water, I've been told it's no different, but how did that get planted in our heads?
Well, it's not all different. It's not all the same. It depends where you live. Tap water is a pretty local and individual issue, but bottled water came onto the scene big time in 1977 with Perrier, but that was just the little green glass bottles, and yuppies were drinking it in urban areas, and, we weren't walking down the street with Perrier bottles. But
because they were glass.
Right. They were glass. They were heavy. It changed in 1989 when bottlers can put water into light, very lightweight, and very cheap clear plastic bottles made of PET plastic. And so that helped the bottlers out a lot. It was cheap to do that. And so the market grew. And then the big change happened in the 90s when Coke and Pepsi got in on it, and they had hundreds of millions of dollars to spend on marketing. And they could very easily move their product out onto shelves that they controlled with their soda. They had an elaborate distribution network. So all these ads played to our aspirations to be beautiful and thin, and, they used models and celebrities and athletes, and they subtly and sometimes not so subtly preyed on this idea that tap water wasn't always so great and that we needed to drink a lot of water. That was another very clever thing they did. They told us to drink more water. Actually, Pepsi had a campaign. It was a $20 million award-winning campaign that said, drink more water. It was that simple.
It's weird, though, because it's almost sort of like they commodified something so basic, something mm-hmm. so elementary.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like saying air, buy air.
Well, they latched onto this idea that we needed to drink a lot of it, or we latched onto it, and so portability became important. And so the bottled water industry will say that we are supplying convenience. They like to say we're not competing with tap, we're supplying convenience, but people have forgotten or... I don't know. I mean, I'm a longtime camper. I have a lot of water bottles, so I never bought water. I always refilled my reusable bottles, and I think we're not all quite used to refilling reusable bottles, and we've forgotten that there are perfectly good spigots in all the cafes we go to and corner stores. People have sinks. There are public drinking water fountains, and it's okay to use them.
Yeah, I've become a real rebel with that. I'm like, I'm going to go ahead and use a public water fountain. I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm standing up for my rights
Be
to drink
proud.
Water right out of
yeah.
the pipe. Now how is this corrupted, first of all, how is it bad for us on the level of what is it doing to some of the more natural resources? This water's got to be coming from somewhere. Does it compromise our ability to just have free water?
Well, some people think it does. There's a couple different things going on. First, we're talking about the environment. There's the carbon footprint of making all the bottles, all the oil it takes to make them and to transport them around.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the pumping of groundwater to do the spring waters that we drink that we like so much. The two leading brands in this country are made by Coke and Pepsi, and they use municipal water supplies. And so they're coming from surface waters mostly. And then they filter them and put them in the bottles. But some people complain that overpumping of spring water is changing surrounding ecosystems. And there's a lot of debate about this. The Sierra Club says that spring water pumping has dried up wetlands and lowered stream levels and affected fish populations because they take clear, cold water from headwaters, right? They want
right.
springs. And so that's great trout habitat. And so some people charge them with degrading
Oh, my God.
But they deny it, of course. And then the other issue is, as more and more people abandon municipal supplies and drink bottled water, will there be enough political support out there to support watershed protection and improving the infrastructure so that everyone has great access to affordable tap water? And it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we drink more bottled water, we're going to have to drink more bottled water, because tap water will degrade to the point where only those who can't afford it are drinking it, and that would be a national tragedy.
And yeah, you'd have to drink bottled everything. My God. And then capitalism wins, the corporations win, and we're forever beholden because we've let them destroy everything.
Wow. Well, that's a little apocalyptic, but I mean, people talk
this
about
this is our America.
The global water shortage, right? And this is why I tell the story in my book about Freiburg, Maine, and the people there who are fighting with Nestle. I have to keep reminding myself and my readers in the book, why should we care about Freiburg and this bottle of Poland Spring water? And the answer is because access to clean, easily available clean fresh water is limited. We're not making any more of it on the earth. The population's going up, the climate's changing, so the water is becoming scarcer and therefore more valuable. And are we going to let corporations own more and more of these sources? Whose hand do you want on the tap?
Well, I get that, but wait, I was under the impression that water is made occasionally. It comes out of the sky and things come together to
make
more.
But it's the same amount. We've had the same amount for 4.5 billion years, but the population is growing and people are using more of it. And as there's more affluence in the developing world, people are going to want to eat more meat. And as we all know, it takes an enormous amount of water to grow a hamburger. And so, yes, we have the same amount of water, but it's being moved around and polluted faster than ever before.
Oh, my God. So now what about so you're saying that because of the water industry is depleting these resources and crumbling some of the infrastructure that may be permanent, like it's almost like peak oil. We're dealing with peak water here.
Mm-hmm.
And that tap water at this point, depending where you are, is perfectly fine to drink.
Well, that's a big depending, because it's easy for me in New York City to say, yeah, let's drink our tap water. It's really great. But there are people across the country who drink bottled water for a good reason. Their tap water is contaminated with industrial contaminants, chemicals, agricultural chemicals, and utilities don't have enough money to invest in advanced treatment technology, or they can't retain good help to do the right monitoring.
So in that picture, the corporations that have figured out a way to not honor any environmental protection laws are dumping crap into the water supply, and as usual, the government is underfunded in things that they need to be funded with to effectively clean up
right.
for the government's permissive attitudes toward corporate pollution.
Well, that's sure.
I'm sorry. I just wanted
That is. I mean, there are pollutants in the water, and we can take them out. We have the technology. I write about Kansas City, which drinks from the Missouri River, which has a whole lot of contaminants from industrial agriculture, from concentrated animal feeding operations upstream, from corn growing. There's a problem with atrazine, an herbicide, and nitrogen and phosphorus, all this stuff. But it's an incredible utility. They do a great job of cleaning up the water and make a beautiful product. But I say in the book, if we didn't put in all this stuff in the first place, we wouldn't have to spend the energy and the chemicals and the time taking it out. And in a perfect world, the polluters would be stopped.
That's a broader environmental problem. You're saying that depending where the water is, it could be this toxic soup of pee, poop, and pesticides. That needs to be filtered out, and ultimately, if the country was working properly, we would have a little more respect for our basic resources.
Right.
And so what can people do? Let's go there. Let's get out of the apocalypse and into the solution.
I think people should arm themselves with knowledge and don't just assume your tap water is bad because you've got this vague ill feeling from the bottled water advertisers. Find out for sure. Look at your right to know report from your utility. If you have a well, get it tested. Go even further. When you look at your consumer confidence report from the utility, it measures the water or it tests the water before it gets to your house. So you have to think about the pipes in your house. So go ahead and have your water tested at the tap. And most people in this country will be hugely reassured that their water is perfectly healthy for them to drink.
You know what's sad about what we were talking about before and just about people in general is that you just, like, read off about five things that they would have to do just to figure out whether or not they could drink out of their tap. And a lot of people at the second one was like, I got to, what's she?
It's a one-time, test your water at the tap. Okay, forget about looking at the report, okay?
Yeah.
You're going to shell out this money, but you're going to save money in the long run. It's so much cheaper than buying bottled water. So you'll save money. You'll save the environment. We won't have to deal with all these empty plastic bottles. And if you find something distasteful in your water, you're going to get a filter. And the filter will cost you some money up front, but you're going to save money in the long run by buying the filters. And maybe you don't even need a filter.
I use a Brita filter myself.
Great. Me too.
Okay. Well, thank you. Is there a website I can send people to?
Yeah. It's bottlemania.net. And I've got links there to how to find someone to test your water. You have to go to a certified lab. How to learn about filters.
Oh my God, we're dealing with guys in lab coats. We got to bring the water to the lab.
No, you mail it. You mail it to them. It's easy. It's fun. You get this incredible report in the mail. And
you can have your kids do it.
What?
You can have your kids do it.
Yeah, it's a science experiment. So go to my website, bottlemania.net. Look at the links, how to learn about your water, where it comes from, the differences between bottled waters, problems with it, things that are great about it, blah, blah, blah. And then buy my book because it's really actually fun to read.
I had fun talking to you. I can't imagine it wouldn't be fun to read.
Thanks.
Thanks, Elizabeth Roy. Take care. Bye. The book is Bottle Mania, How Water Went on Sale and Why We Bought It. I want people to know right now that I am fighting a good fight and drinking tap water as we speak. We'll be back with your calls, 866-303-2270. It's always the second hour that I finally loosen up and don't think I have to know everything. I feel a lot more comfortable. I think I'm going to take a nap. All right, look. No, I'm not. Hang out. All right? It's Marinin for Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at
866-303-2270. Okay, coming up on about 5 before the hour. Folks, it's Mark Marinin for Tom Hartman. Talking about water, I know some people think that you shouldn't ever drink any of it out of the tap and you should only drink it's one of those. Some days, it's hard to have hope. And you just got to put a little faith in our ability as animals to adapt to some crap because some things ain't going to change. If you listen to all the information out there about how toxic everything is, which it is, and you think about the journey back to some sort of pristine Eden-like place, or even halfway there. Look, this is funny. I don't know if you saw this, but I guess some of these right-wing sites that subscribe to the Associated Press feed and then post on their own sites, they use the autocorrect change button it has an autocorrect change function. Like, for instance, that some of them will change, that Democratic Party will change to Democrat Party. It's an agenda switching thing that, they actually program the thing to fit their agenda. But apparently the American Family Association's One News Now website, with its Associated Press articles, they replace the word gay, if it comes through the wire, automatically with the word homosexual. And apparently what happened is that through one of these right-wing watch organizations, there was someone found it. I'm looking at a piece from Salon.com, but someone found that there was an article that ran on the American Family Association's One News Now website that reported about sprinter, the runner Tyson Gay, who had won the 100 meters at the U.S. Olympic track and field trials over the weekend. And so the AFA ran the story after it went through autocorrect. So I'm quoting the story. Tyson, homosexual, easily won his semifinal for the 100 meters at the U.S. Olympic track and field trials and seemed to have something for the final later Sunday. His win aided 9.85 seconds was a fairly cut-and-dry performance compared to what happened a day earlier. On Saturday, homosexual misjudged the finish in his opening heat and had to scramble to finish fourth. Then in his quarterfinal, a couple hours later, ran 9.77 to break the American record that had stood since 1999. Homosexual didn't get off to a particularly strong start in the first semifinal, but by the halfway mark, he had established a comfortable lead. Asked how he felt, homosexual said, quote, a little fatigued, unquote. Isn't it fun when Orwellian tactics go awry? It is. Next hour, I'll take a quick call. Susan, South Carolina, you've been there a long time, and I'm sure that you're feeling like we're off your topic, but I'll listen.
Well, no, it really is all part of the whole problem of our country,
right on.
Our culture from way, way back, and there's a fantastic independent film that was just made. It's called What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire, and I highly recommend it to you and your listeners. Basically kind of shows us where this culture went wrong, and, you know, there's a lot of different places, but I think the problem is that we've been taught that growth is equal to consumerism, and
right.
We've been taught that to grow, we have to buy more stuff, and in
right.
order to buy more stuff, we have to make more stuff, and we have to rape and pillage the earth and all of its resources, and we have to use up people as workers to work long hours away from their families to make
yeah.
this stuff so that we can all go out and buy this stuff. And really, this is at the root of a lot of our problems.
Zero-sum game. Right.
Environmentally and
yep.
spiritually. This is why we're so spiritually dead, is because this stuff can't make us happy. And we have thought that that's the growth that we wanted, when really the growth that we needed was to grow as human beings in spirit and in compassion and in health and wisdom and all those
appreciate
wonderful
it.
Things.
Absolutely right. I appreciate your call, Susan. You're absolutely right. And I've got to stop relying on coffee to make me feel better. I've got to stop relying on my nice pants. The list goes on. I'll be back in a second. It's Marin in for Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course, you lurking conservatives, it's Mark Maron. I'm in for Tom Hartman. That music that he plays makes me shimmy and shake like an after-school special song. It's sort of like that you don't get too far into the groove, you just sort of go, hey, it's almost like a commercial for goodness. Just general goodness, not identified with any brand. You know what? And I'll be honest with you. Oh, are you kidding me? Is he really on the phone? Then we'll talk about that in a minute. Some of you may not know him, but here he comes. Folks, since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that listeners know what's going on in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world, so here now is our very own Planet Push Bureau Chief, Lawton Smalls. Hello, Lawton.
Hello, Mark. God's cleaning his pool. And he's skimming the dead bugs off your soul.
Oh, it's great. It's great to talk to you, man. So
you
I,
too, Mark. Hey, I'm looking at you on Marin Vision. You got on your little gator shirt.
Yes,
very
I
impressive.
Yeah, I'm trying to do the preppy thing. I think I'm selling it. Look, I know you've been following the campaign there, Lawton.
Mm-hmm.
So let's be honest. I mean, who do you like as vice president?
Mark.
Yes.
I think it is in astonishingly bad taste to even discuss the future while President George W. two terms mandate Bush is still busy fulfilling his vision for America.
Uh-huh.
Why would anyone want this era to be over is beyond me.
Mm.
Employment up, terrorism down, surveillance up, gas prices down, Jesus up, Russ Feingold down.
Mm-hmm.
You should be savoring every minute of this glorious time. We're all just biscuits swimming in W's gravy, soaking up his creamy goodness.
I don't. You know what, Lawton? We're swimming in something, all right, but I don't think it's gravy.
Okay,
listen to me. Focus, buddy. What do you think? I mean, well, who do you think Barack Obama should pick as his running mate, honestly?
Oh, all right. Well, he can't pick the obvious choice.
Who's that, Hillary?
Bin Laden.
Oh,
he's still hiding in his
uh-huh.
cave, so that won't work. You can't kiss many babies in swing states from your
mm-hmm.
cave.
Uh-huh.
And he can't pick Nancy Pelosi. She's too busy killing babies at her drive-by on-demand abortion hut.
Uh-huh.
Cross that one off. No Nancy.
All right, what about Hillary?
I'm not here to aid and comfort the enemy. But if Hussein Obama picked Hillary... He's crazy as a bedbug hopped up on Red Bull and Special K. That woman is a serial emasculator.
Oh, my God.
Mark my words. Uh-huh. If they ran together within 3 weeks, she'd have Obama wearing a skirt.
Oh, my God.
He's got the legs for it, but that's not the point. Not at all. He'd all be wearing a skirt.
All right, listen. All right. Okay. So what do you think? Then who do you think John McCain should pick? Huckabee?
Well, you know, I think Huck would be a good choice
uh-huh.
if he put back on all that weight that he lost, 110 pounds. People in this country could identify with something like that. Leadership. Take that, snob Obama, and your elitist anti-American 32-inch waist. Eat a donut, mister.
Okay, I get it. All right. All right. What about Mitt Romney?
Well, about Mitster, I respect the fact
mm-hmm.
that he inherited his wealth.
Right.
To me, that shows character, leadership. I can trust
him. Oh,
that.
God. All right, anyone else?
Well, here's my short list.
Yeah.
Jack Abramoff,
yeah.
Tom DeLay,
mm-hmm.
Duke Cunningham,
yeah.
good people, Jeff Gannon, Larry Craig, Bob Ney. I think he's out of prison, halfway house. He could just go right out and campaign.
Yeah.
But, Annie, Mark,
yeah.
everybody's overlooking the obvious
yeah.
choice.
All right, who's that, Lawton?
Dick, two terms, mandate change.
Okay.
Why couldn't he just stay in there and save on moving costs? The man's fit as a fiddle and ready for love. Can't you just see it? McCain, Cheney. The kids will be dropping Obama for that ticket in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah, buddy. That's a real youth quake right there, that ticket.
It is.
Uh-huh.
I got a slogan all picked out.
Uh-huh.
McCain, Cheney, change without change. You like it? Hmm?
Change without change. You know, you want to know what I think, Lawton? Seriously. You want to know what I think?
That it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Who McCain chooses.
That's right.
Because he's screwed.
That's right.
It doesn't matter at all, does it?
No.
It doesn't matter.
No. Nope.
McCain can pick Jesus, and he's still going to lose.
That's right.
He can pick Will Smith. He can pick Angelina pregnant and her two twins. The guy is still screwed. Cranky and creepy. Wait till the debates. McCain's going to look real good standing up there on the stage next to Obama. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Who are you going to vote for, America? The basketball star or the principal?
Exactly.
McCain wants to give us all detention. Detention.
Yeah.
I can't.
Yeah, he probably will, Lawton. He probably will. We take it easy, please. Pull it together. All right, just pull it together.
Michelle Malkin, I think, would make an excellent vice president.
All right.
Very president.
Yeah.
Joe Scarborough.
Uh-huh.
Michael Savage.
Uh-huh.
Matt Drudge.
All right. Goodbye, Lawton. Goodbye.
God loves you, Mark. Deal with it.
All right. Thank you, Lawton. Always a pleasure. Now, folks, I'm going to talk about this is something. This is what I just started to realize. I think I was talking about a little bit of Monday. Now, you know that Starbucks is closing 600 company-operated stores in the next year because of the economy. Okay, and these are stores that were opened recently, and now you know SUV sales are crapping out. The auto industry is crapping out, and you know what? Honestly, there's some weird silver lining here. I know that the economy is bad, and we're all trying to figure out how we're going to get through it, and what kind of trims we're going to make in our lives, and what kind of compromises we have to make, and hopefully they're not so great that we lose everything. But the truth of the matter is, I believe if more people are making their own coffee in the morning, if more people are traveling out less, if more people are spending more time at home cooking their own food, being reasonable about what they put in their bodies because of the money problem, that maybe they'll start to realize that they can actually do those things. You can have your own coffee at home. It's actually fun to make your own coffee. You can buy groceries that aren't pre-prepared. You can cook your own fish and steak if you want, maybe some rice. You can do all these things and actually, you know, follow a fairly strict budget and learn how to be a person who makes things. You can have more people over to your house. You can make big pots of stuff. There's all kinds of things that could happen. You could turn your TV off. You could turn your computer off to save electrical. You could turn your car off and not travel as much. You could start preparing your own food at home and pacing yourself properly, preparing for the week. You could become a real person because you have to for money reasons. But in the long run, it could really show you some not only good survival tactics, but that you have new skills. Is this crazy? Am I being too optimistic? I think I'm trying to help because I'm one of those people like, I don't throw anything away. Like, I actually belong to Costco specifically to buy nicotine gum because it's cheap. And when you like drugs, if you can find cheap drugs that are good, you go to that place. So nicotine gum, good deal at Costco. That's the only drug I do, by the way. Caffeine, nicotine, that's where I'm at right now. But the problem with me is that I made the mistake of buying some vegetables at Costco. And I don't know what your experience is with that, but I live by myself now. And there was some part of me that thought, like, yeah, I could use that two-ton bag of spinach and maybe that crate of blueberries. And what there's, I'll get through all those cherries, even though it's a box the size of, like, a baby carriage. So I bring all this stuff home, and I hate to waste anything. So that was a pretty bad week, consumed with stomach problems, and it was almost like a challenge that every day I'd open the refrigerator, and I'm like, oh, my God. Look at the size. There's still that much broccoli left? All right. It was cheap, and there's a lot of it, and I'm going to rise to the occasion. And I ate it all. Am I healthier because of it? I don't know. It was kind of a rough week. So, look, I'm going to take some calls, and I swear to God I'm going to do it. A little later in the show, we're going to have Jim Wolcott from Vanity Fair is going to come in, my old buddy Jim. We're going to talk probably more about Barack Obama. He's got a little beef with Bob Kerry, who wrote a little opinion piece in the Daily News. That'll be interesting. Perhaps we'll get into the fact that, I don't know if we're going to get into that. Apparently, though, the U.S. government learned all their torture tricks from a manual from Chinese Communist China that had been interpreted in the late 50s. And apparently some of the torture devices and methods that they incorporated into their treatment of terror suspects at Gitmo were actually taken from this Chinese manual, which was actually designed to get false confessions, prolonged torture to get false confessions out of prisoners to support the ideology of the communists. What does that tell you about this policy? Not only is torture wrong, but from the very beginning, these guys knew that they were doing a type of torture that would make them say what they wanted to say to support their ideology to execute this war based on the lie that they had designed right from the ground up. And they were killing, you know, they were just torturing the hell out of these guys, not even looking for truth, just looking for something that fit what they wanted. But anyways, we'll talk about anything. You want to talk about coffee? That's fine. 16 past, Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-302-7070. Okay,
folks, 20 past, Mark Maron in for Tom Hartman. Hope you're okay. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. I hate that. It's always a lie. Fine is always a lie. How you doing? Fine. What you're really saying is help me. Please help. I'm in trouble. Seriously. I'm in trouble. Can't say that, though, because then they'll just say, you'll be fine, which means I got to go. Yeah. Look, I am going to talk to you people right now. Sandra in San Francisco, California, my old hometown. How are you?
Hi.
How are you?
I really am fine.
Good. I'm glad to hear
that. Authentically.
That's pretty. But
let me tell you, okay. I am very glad to finally hear someone talking some sense.
Yeah.
What you're talking about is a program I set out for myself 5 years ago or more.
Yeah.
Because actually, I had started already when I was in Mexico City.
You're referring to what?
To changing my lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
Reducing everything. Coffee, I was told not to drink coffee anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to give up coffee.
Right.
So I researched and found out all about organics and
sure.
so on. And I recommend if you can't give up coffee, great, just don't. You don't have to do it. Just get a good coffee.
Right, but your point is that if you adjust your lifestyle to the current economic status of the world,
right.
that you may learn something about yourself. You may learn some discipline. You may learn how to enjoy things in a different way. That
mm-hmm.
that you know, in a lot of ways, the mm-hmm. fact that we rely so much on credit and spending beyond our means and going out for dinner and driving gratuitously or unnecessarily is that it really aids in keeping us away from our basic natures and what we might find joy or happiness in, which can be very simple.
Right, right. I have learned a lot about what food to buy and how to cook it and so on and so forth. It's an adventure.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm glad. That was very encouraging. I appreciate that. Hey, Hank in Grand Rapids, what's up, buddy? You on board with this?
Yeah. You said you use a Brita filter?
I do use a Brita filter in the pitcher that I drink water out of.
Yeah, what do you use when you make coffee?
What I do when I make coffee, I have sort of a complicated process. I buy a fairly cheap coffee from the Fresh and Easy grocery store.
For water?
I use the Brita water.
Oh, okay.
Is that all right?
Most people, if they're using tap water,
yeah,
the chlorine in there queers the coffee taste.
Yeah, no, I use the Brita filtered water. I boil it in an electric teapot, and then I pour it into a cone, and then I transfer that to a thermos. It's a
Whoa.
Very, yeah, see, it's, see, this is what you gotta do. Like, in the meantime, I'm listening to the radio, but I got big science projects going on every morning, Hank.
Alright, well, if people wanted to save, some money on their coffee grounds.
Yeah.
They could use tap water that's warm water, the hot side.
Okay.
Because your hot water heater will boil off the chlorine.
Well, thank you for the advice.
And you'll find out you can use less coffee. If you use the same amount of coffee, you'll have a more strong coffee.
Thank you very much.
Less coffee.
I appreciate that, Hank.
Bye-bye.
You take care. It's interesting what engages people, and I just learned a little something. I think we all learned a little something that could change our day-to-day life, not just our thinking. Turn on that hot water tap. Gary, Fallbrook, California. What do you got for me, my friend?
Hi, Mark.
Hi.
I'm really enjoying your show and in pretty much total agreement with everything you've said. But I did have make an odd connection there when you were talking. Well, first of all, you were talking about religion and the mindset which goes with being religious.
Yeah.
And I think of that as most likely a person who is more comfortable with absolutes than with nuance.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely right. Yeah, it's much easier to generalize and to know things.
So then the most recent caller before the break was a woman who made a few comments, and you said, you're absolutely right. And I thought to myself, absolutely. First of all, I would have preferred you said, I'm in substantial agreement with you or something like that, because, of course, she's not absolutely right.
Okay. Yeah.
But I thought the connection between absolutes and religion and the absolutely correct was just
okay.
More than I could stand, so I had to call you.
Well, I appreciate your nuancing the situation. I thank you very much.
Hey, you're welcome.
And you know what? And I apologize, because you're right. On a philosophical and logical level, absolutely right is quite a declaration for me to make. And I overstep my bounds, and I am grandiose and irresponsible in my semantics. She was just right for that moment. Because I don't work with absolutes. I am on an ever-shaking foundation with just a few principles in place. And I broke one of them yesterday by giving my phone number to somebody I swore I would never give my phone number to because they're annoying. See, it's the simple things, isn't it? Look, Jim Wolcott is going to come in here in about 10 minutes or so. We're going to try to cover some, and he's great. He's the columnist for Vanity Fair. You can also see his blog on the Vanity Fair /Jim Wolcott. VanityFair.com online. VanityFair.com/online/Wolcott, WOLCOTT. If you're not familiar with his writing, he's a tremendous cultural critic, very smart guy, very witty guy. And I want to talk to him a little bit about, because he had a friend pass away who he had a great deal of respect for, who was once the editor of New York Magazine. And I was having a conversation with a buddy of mine about what has happened to the language of culture, because it really seems like in the 70s, and this was specifically around watching a Woody Allen movie and then watching a movie by Judd Apatow. I don't have any problem with Judd Apatow. But if you're talking about 28 to 30-year-old people in comedies in Woody Allen's time and in this time, the amount of infantilization that has occurred over the past 35 years in terms of how adults behave is fascinating. Because there was a time in this country where the intellectual community and the cultural community was tied together, very urbane, very sophisticated, well-rounded in a lot of ways. And now it's everybody's sort of a child. I'm going to talk to Jim a little bit about that, hopefully. So stay with us. Jim Wolcott coming up next. It's Mark Maron on the Tom Hartman Show.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, folks, it's about 35 past the hour. It's Mark Maron. I'm in for Tom Hartman. It's been fun. We're coming in on the last hour, half hour of the show. I got a good friend of mine, a good friend of my shows in general, and a great writer. James Wolcott is here. He's a columnist for Vanity Fair. He wrote the book Attack Poodles and Other Mutants, The Looting of the News in the Time of Terror. And you can go to his blog right now at www.vanityfair.com/online/Wolcott, W-O-L-C-O-T-T. How are you, Jim?
I'm good. I'm good.
I went to your blog this morning, and you were worked up for you about this. Bob Carey put a, would you call it an opinion piece?
Yeah.
On the Daily News, yeah, about what he thought Barack Obama should do.
Yeah. No, it's funny how, well, first of all, why are you going to take advice from the guy who was backing your opponent? You know, because Kerry was backing Clinton, which is fine. And
right,
then Clinton loses, and it's like, well, here's what you have to do, Obama. It's like, well, why should I listen to you? You were like,
exactly. Be more like my candidate.
Yeah, you know, if you were backing me. But it's also, it's one of those, you know, this is a classic thing. Whenever it looks like the Democrats are close to actually winning something and maybe winning appreciably, all of a sudden we hear these calls for bipartisanship and reaching across and postpartisanship. If you go back and look at what Gingrich and them were doing in the early 90s.
Yeah.
They weren't talking about reaching out to Democrats.
No, they were talking about taking over.
Yeah, taking over, crushing, you know, isolate, you know, quarantining Democrats.
An open-ended contract with America.
Yeah, I mean, so there was none of that, but it's like there's something inbred in like certain type of liberal that they get nervous at the thought that they might actually win and that they might actually like have some power. And it's like, we might have power. We should share that power.
Yeah.
You know, I've actually heard people say, well, you know, what would be really great would be if both Obama and McCain said that they would pick whoever lost the election to serve in their cabinet.
Yeah.
Which is
crazy.
It's crazy.
It's like, let's have an assassin live here.
Yeah. It's like, what is the point of winning if you can't say, okay, now my people move in?
Well, obviously, there's going to have to be diplomacy, and there is politics that have to happen on a legislative level. But I think you're right that as we get closer to things now, because now you're getting from both sides where the left is saying that Barack is moving too near the center, where it's like, ultimately, you got to realize, and I think most of us do, that you do what's necessary to get elected. What anyone's going to do in terms of executing their promises, who the hell knows?
Yeah. Oh, no one knows. Well, what Kerry was recommending, which is something which I think is a terrible rhetorical device, which is that Obama should keep saying, I agree with you, Senator McCain, when you say such and such, and I enlist your support, and I agree with you. Because for one thing, no one is going to prevail on McCain to say the same to Obama. So Obama's going to be making these gestures of, I agree with McCain, I agree with McCain. And then people are going to say, well, you know what? If Obama agrees with McCain so much, why don't I just vote for McCain?
That's true, especially, you know, when there's so many independent voters on the fence.
Yeah.
That,
you know,
and the fact that there are people, doesn't it baffle you that at this point that there are actually people like, oh, I'm still undecided. Well, are you a moron? Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like, and I watch what Wesley Clark said, and I've said that all along, that despite whatever happened and for what reasons it happened to McCain, which I'm not taking away from his experience or saying that he deserved it and that he didn't serve nobly his country, but the fact of the matter is he was a man in a cage for 5 years. He was tortured. He broke under torture. And just because he had that experience does not qualify for anything other than, like, I think his sanity is questionable.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a piece that I think of all places, the American Conservative, that – it was a column about, it was one of their little sort of CIA, sort of counter CIA columns. And they were talking about the briefings that McCain has gotten. And they said that the word is coming back that, first of all, McCain doesn't know a whole lot, even though he's been in the Senate for a long time. He also gets very testy when he's contradicted or he's corrected. But I thought, you know, the fact is that people think because someone's in the Senate, they have a broad range of knowledge. No, they go on these little bubble junkets. You know, they get fed the information. There's no evidence that McCain has his own kind of natural curiosity. So he has a very limited worldview, you know. So what they're trying to do is say, they're trying to paint this picture that, you know, he had this traumatic experience and then, you know, from that he broadened out and he embraced and, you know, and he is now an expert. In fact, there's no reason to believe that he knows a whole lot.
That's absolutely right, because like most senators, if they're not clear on the issues, they ask their assistant or the page is like, how are we voting on this?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. There you go.
He apparently mixes up the Shia and the Sunnis just as much as Bush did before the election.
And he's actually said that he has not a firm grasp on economic policy. He really is, curiously, a perfect Manchurian candidate. That he's a guy that will do whatever's necessary. And I believe, I don't know what you believe, but I've been saying this publicly, that I think that the fact that the Republicans are running John McCain only means that they don't really want to win.
Well, you know, part of it, it's hard to know because, you know, part of it is he really did get in on a fluke because the whole primary really rested on no one anticipated that Mike Huckabee was going to destroy Mitt Romney.
Right.
Because people really thought Romney was going to coast because he had all that money. He's got the Hollywood looks. No one anticipated that Huckabee was going to wreck. And also, very few people, I mean, including myself, I thought Fred Thompson would be a much better candidate than he turned out to be. I mean, I didn't think he was going to win, but I didn't realize he was going to, like, just really phone it in. He's like, well, I don't feel like taking it.
Right when that gate came up, he was like, I don't think I can run.
I'm a little tired. I'm going to ride in a golf cart around Iowa, so McCain really kind of squeaked through. I mean, because if you read the right-wing blogs, conservative blogs, they're not terribly happy either. I mean, they're not in love with their guy.
Well, and the thing was, is the feeling I got, which happens a lot in politics, and the reason I'm basing my broad opinion that they don't really want it. If he wins, it's mm-hmm. a sad indication of how far gone this country is. Mm-hmm. But is that he strikes me as one of those guys like Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull. It's like you're going to have to throw. I think he threw the last one. I think he was their choice before W. And I think that he's one of these guys that's been sitting around a long time, and they're doing him a favor somehow.
Well, there are real echoes of when they ran Bob Dole, mm-hmm. and that same sense of like war. You know, he was a war survivor and honorable man, but they don't really believe he could be president. I mean, no one really thought Dole could take over the country. And I think it may be, they may hope that they may have that, you know, because a lot of them have convinced themselves that Obama is Jimmy Carter. So even if Obama wins, he'll be a disastrous one-term president. And then the Republicans will come roaring back.
That's what I think. I think that they're going to leave him holding this bag of flaming poop.
Mm-hmm.
That is almost the pit that we're in to even get it to something manageable is going to require more than one term. So, yeah. I mean, he's really got his work cut out for him, but yeah. I think they're gambling.
And I think as soon as he is sworn in, it won't be just the Republicans. You're going to have David Broder and all those people at the Washington Post telling Obama, you really have to pick moderate Republicans for your cabinet. You're going to have to reach out and do this. They're going to like try to do everything they can to emasculate him.
Right.
You know, right out at the get-go.
Yeah. Well, I really think he's emotionally and mentally a dangerous man, and I don't think he's that intelligent. And now he seems to have cloistered himself. He seems to be, you know, he has to moderate Republicans. How about now he's running around with Lieberman everywhere.
Yeah.
And Lindsey Graham, like these proxies, he can't even talk for himself when he's, you know, right there.
I know. And it's like, I mean, I think the three of them are now down in Columbia. I mean, it's like, what is...
The Colombian vote's it's a very powerful block.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that's odd about it is that you don't make yourself look presidential by going on what looks like a senatorial junket. I mean, he's saying that it's a different thing, but when you're there with fellow senators, it really does look like a junket.
Yeah.
You know, and my guess is that when Obama goes to foreign, you know, when he goes, he's going to be alone. He's going to be standing there. He's going to look like leadership.
That's right.
You know.
That's right.
I'm going to shoot him at a low angle so that he's, like, towering over the sky.
Yeah. You know? And maybe he'll go someplace important, like China, Europe.
You know, like, yeah.
The Eastern Bloc, Colombia.
Yeah. Well, he'll go to Afghanistan. He'll go to Iraq. But I noticed that McCain is not really even getting that much coverage for this trip. Because for one thing, the media can't afford to send anybody anywhere. So they got to like depend on, you know.
Is that really what's happening?
I think so.
They're depending on video bloggers in Colombia.
They're sending footage back, you know.
On these weird handheld Zoom
cameras.
It'll
be the first time they're using footage from like Telemundo.
And they were shooting something else probably.
Doing English dubs over the, you know.
That's where it's at. That's where it's happening now. Well, now, I mean, what do you make of that idea, though, that we were talking about before? Because, like we were saying, that the right is, the left is really sort of taking Obama to task for this idea that he's moving center. And what it seems to me is that it's a very calculated campaign strategy to get what he needs to get done in order to get into the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem that I don't know why I don't hold him to I don't find that he's shifting his ideas. It's just in my heart, it's like, look, he's our guy. Let's let him do it. Mm-hmm. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, I think he has to be careful not to stick it too hard to the left and say, you know, in order to move, you know, sort of like flaunt it in front of them. You know, I think in a way that the whole thing about the faith-based initiative is kind of, you know, wickedly clever, because what he's saying is, oh, I'm not going to dismantle this. I'm going to build it bigger. Then, you know, it's like, well, what kind of, you know, you could then use it to fund money to all your little pet projects. You know, it's like, oh, you thought it was all going to go to, right-wing evangelical churches. Well, no, maybe we have like a social mission to alleviate poverty that a religious group is doing.
That's right.
And we're going to fund that, you know, and it's like, so, you know, then the conservatives are in the position of, well, they, you know, because they loved this thing before, you know.
And he's basically rephrasing or actually reinventing what it's supposed to do in an across the board way, and actually trying to say that they will honor it. I don't know how our discussion we had here earlier was how do you have oversight? In that situation.
Yeah. Oh, there are always going to be problems, because you're going to have churches that say, we don't recognize gay marriage, and then, or we don't recognize this. And, you know, but it's interesting. He's like, because one of the things he's clearly doing, and article after article points this out, is he is reaching out to the evangelicals, because they know that the evangelicals are not smitten with McCain.
Right.
And if McCain picks Mitt Romney as his running mate, and that's one of the rumors, you know, I mean, he's one of the candidates. You've really got an opportunity, because there's a whole part of the country that the Mormonism just freaks them out.
Yeah, it freaks me out. I'm part of that part of the country. they freak me out a little bit. But I think also that, you know, when you're talking about evangelicals, is they vote their gut, they vote their sense of somebody's commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's non-specific in policy, if they can sense a commitment to Jesus.
Yeah,
no, I
think that's true. I mean, I think that's part of the huge bond they had with Bush.
Yeah,
you know, because Bush came to them and said, you know, I was a drinker, and now I'm fine. And they bought it and they believed it. And I don't think they clearly don't feel that same way about McCain.
No, McCain's erratic, and he's like, see, I tend to, my analysis of things, it gets a little hazy when I start to see, like, oh, he's got those weird reptilian eyes. You know, like, he's got those weird black orbs that just, you know, burn through you. He's on some weird medicine that they're giving him, some sort of cocktail concocted by big pharmaceutical companies to make him the guy that he's supposed to be. Is that crazy?
Well, I don't, you know, I'll tell you what I think I think it could be his downfall. You ever seen him when he starts kind of almost like doing a verbal rap of like jokes? When he's kind of rap? Yeah. First of all, his jokes are really old.
Yeah.
And you know, you just know he's this far from doing one that's going to be really in bad taste.
Yeah.
He's going to pick some group, because he loves apparently to tease people.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw like one of these town hall things, and he was like, It really was like grandpa mumbling to himself.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a little creepy, because he's obviously having a little work done. But look, we're going to finish this conversation in a minute. My guest is James Wolcott from Vanity Fair. I do want to talk a little bit about a friend of yours passed away, who used to be the editor of New York Magazine in its heyday. And I want to try to get into a broader look at how culture became so infantile and retarded. And I'm using that word correctly, I think. Don't criticize me for that. So we're going to try and get into that in a second. So stay with us. It's Mark Maron for Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270. All right,
folks, we're coming in for landing here. It's Mark Maron. I'm in for Tom Hartman. My guest is James Wolcott, the Vanity Fair columnist. You can also go to his blog at www.vanityfair.com/online Wolcott, W-O-L-C-O-T-T. Now, I read your blog, and a guy you were close with or knew, Clay Felker, who was the editor of New York Magazine for years, has passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry you lost a friend. And I'm also was sort of reflecting on when I was a kid, because you sort of put it in a nostalgic frame, that it seems to me that when we were younger, that pop culture and that culture at large seemed more intelligent. Mm-hmm. That New York Magazine, you know, was sort of dictated what was hip and cool in New York, but it also published a lot of writers at the time mm-hmm. that were actually real literary giants mm-hmm. and journalists that were really cutting edge. And it just seems that now, like, I guess my big question is, I had a discussion with a friend of mine, that how did we get from Annie Hall to Knocked Up? Now, I'm not going to mm-hmm. I'm not saying that Judd Apatow is not producing something that is bad, because mm-hmm. I found myself charmed by the mm-hmm. movies. But the adults in those movies, and they are adults, act like teenagers. And the adults in Annie Hall act like overly intelligent people that were on the cutting edge of music, art, mm-hmm. literature. And that used to be what pop culture was.
I know. Well, you know, there's one theory, and I would say I totally subscribe to it, but it's an interesting theory, which is during the, like, 60s and 70s, there was a real genuine interest in this country in foreign culture, particularly like foreign film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Woody Allen would have been just another stand-up comic if it hadn't been for the fact that all those Ingmar Bergman films and Fellini films really got into his head. I mean, he's at least five or six of his movies are practically remakes of Bergman or Fellini.
That's right, yeah.
And that, in a sense, the theory is that the European culture, which like inspired people, was also kind of like the adult culture that a lot of Americans like aspire to, American artists. It's
right.
Like, this is how we're going to show that we're grown up so mature, is we're going to do our own version. Like, you know, Paul Mazursky, who is another, you know, director and actor and, you know, a screenwriter. I mean, he made movies that were like emulated Fellini and Bergman and Truffaut. Truffaut was, and so this theory goes that now there's no interest in European art, European culture at all in this country.
Right.
We're much more cut off and parochial now than we were 30 or 40 years ago. So now we're left to our own devices, and it's like we've sunk back into the adolescence.
That's interesting.
That was always there, latent.
So there's something you're saying that that what we're seeing now actually has more integrity and honesty as of what America really is.
It, you know, it may be because it's like, well, look what we're doing. It's like comic book movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, before, you know, even the action movies, like if you go back to the action movies of the 70s, they were emulating certain models. Like so many people like ripped off from Kurosawa, you know, the Seven
right.
Samurai, like
sure.
Peckinpah, you know, the slow motion, all that came out. Now it really is. It's all graphic novels, video games, you know.
And it's just a black and white universe. It's good and evil.
Yeah.
And there's no nuances. There's no, you know, internal challenges. So some of the superheroes do have some darkness and internal challenges.
Yeah.
But how it relates to real life and the grit of existence is different. And then you have the Knocked Up movie, which is really the people that watch superhero movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm guilty of it myself. I just wonder that, you know, the digression of sophistication in that model is that the Americans are actually being more honest than they ever have been.
Well, I think there's something to it. The other thing about Judd Apatow is interesting is when he did the show Freaks and Geeks was actually much more sophisticated and sharper than the movies he's made.
Right.
It's like he's making, you know, the movies are in a way are dumbed down in a way that the show wasn't.
Right.
Because, I mean, I've seen some of the others and it's like, you know, it's just, I mean, the one with McLovin, I mean, where they're just kind of just sitting around talking, well, you know, just all this like smut talk going on like endlessly.
Yeah.
Like we're back in the 50s or something.
That's right, or seventh grade. It speaks to the fact that, you know, when you actually play to the age group of 14 to 35, that, you know, emotionally and intellectually, many of them are at that level of seventh grade.
And the funny thing is, a lot of the people writing these things are, in fact, Harvard graduates.
Yeah.
You know, they're not like, you know.
So it's just a business model.
You know.
Or they might be infantile emotionally.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim. I appreciate seeing you. It's always great talking to you.
It's good to talk to you.
James Wolcott is here. Go to his blog, www.vanityfair.com/online/Wolcott. It was a pleasure hosting for Tom. Thank you, Clay. Thank you, Lauren. Thank you for listening. Tom will be back tomorrow. Have a good day, folks.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.